Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. We've recently had an episode about sharks. It was with Dr. David Schiffman. If you haven't listened to it, go back, check it out because it's great. But as with all of my episodes, I always think there's way more to cover and my guest this week, Dr. Catherine McDonald, completely agrees. We start by talking about shark finning, a fishing practice that is inhumane and barbaric but is not quite understood by everyone, including myself. I asked Catherine the basic questions and I'm glad I did, as I learned so much about not only why it's a problem, but why it even exists in the first place. However, it's not just fishing practices that are the problems in the oceans, it's people's perception of sharks and the ocean itself. Catherine is an advocate for changing people's views from everything from when sharks bite people to the treatment of the oceans themselves. This show is extremely informative and important. Our oceans are constantly under threat and change is needed and it starts with you. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Catherine, welcome to Into the Wild. Thank you very much for joining me on today's show. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I've been looking forward to this chat. And as I said to you a minute ago, we struggled with time difference, but we got there in the end, didn't we?
We did. It just took a minute or two.
Yeah, a few back and forward emails to go, no, wait a minute. Is it -4 hours, -5 hours? No, we've got it. It was a bit embarrassing, but we're there.
I blame daylight savings time.
Yeah, believe me, I blame that for everything in England as well. It's a very archaic thing, but we seem to stick with it. It's very confusing. Well, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to chat to you today. We're going to be talking about shark conservation. We've recently had an episode about sharks, but this time we're going to dive a bit deeper, no pun intended, and be talking about the conservation and the population numbers of sharks, and then a bit about rays as well. So, but before we crack on with that, let's, for my listeners, bring them up to speed. Can you please explain to us who you are and what is it you do?
Of course. My name is Dr. Catherine McDonald, and I am a co-founder and the director of Field School, which is a marine science training organization that teaches students how to do field work in marine science, especially with coastal sharks. Mm. And I'm also a lecturer at the University of Miami, where I teach graduate courses in marine conservation biology.
I would imagine for you, you've probably had a interest and a love for marine life and certainly wildlife, but do you remember kind of when and how your love for wildlife began?
So I was one of those like very dirty kids, just, you know, outside all the time. And I wasn't, you know, I think some people come to conservation from growing up camping or hiking or, and for me, it was sort of running wild in my local public park.
Yeah.
But just, I loved being outside and nature always felt very amazing to me. So, you know, especially because I loved the ocean, it came naturally to me. I didn't grow up near the ocean, but my great-grandparents lived in coastal South Carolina. And so when I went down there from when I was a little kid, you know, I was so excited about crabs. So once you got to sharks, forget about it.
So you were a big fan of, like, when you were going to visit your grandparents, it was looking for crabs and, like, rock pool areas more so.
Yeah, it was basically adults trying to keep me from smearing mud all over whatever dress I was put in for my great-grandparents.
So that's interesting, though, because a few people I've spoken to in the wildlife world that work in the marine side of things, they never seem to grow up around the ocean. I'm always wondering whether it's a draw to that, whether it's that... although you had your grandparents to go and visit near the coastal areas, whether it's like you're not near it, so you want to get nearer to it and you want to, you know, kind of explore into that. Do you think that's an element for yourself?
I don't know that it drew me because I didn't have it, but I do think that there's some subset of the population that feels called to the ocean. Mm. And it doesn't matter where you come from. I work with amazing marine biologists who grew up in Indiana, in Illinois, which for UK listeners are not anywhere near the ocean.
Thank you. It's interesting though, isn't it? Because like one thing me and my housemates were saying when lockdown first happened, about a few weeks in for us, we suddenly had this draw, like you said, to just want to be by the beach. We wanted to be by the ocean and we have no idea why. Maybe it was just because we hadn't had a holiday and we'd just come out of winter. But it was that kind of... that real draw, and like you said, I agree, I think it's in us all to suddenly, especially in times of high stress and high kind of angst, and anxiety. We're kind of like, I want to be near water. I don't know what that is. I get that very much so.
I read somewhere, and I don't know how reputable this argument is. Certainly, there's a lot of psychological literature that says people find natural green spaces and natural blue spaces soothing.
Mm.
But I read something that suggested that maybe we're into the ocean because if you're a, you know, an early human and you're standing on the beach, basically all of your threats have to come from the forest in front of you. So you can put your back to the ocean confident that nothing is coming up out of it after you.
We're going to be talking about shark conservation, but there's a specific point we wanted to talk about, me and you, when we were planning this, and this was shark finning. Now, I've read a bit about this topic before. I would say I know next to nothing about it apart from what I've seen on TV and in the media, which, again, isn't much. So let's really look at this, and let's go back to the basics. Can you, for the listeners and myself, explain what shark finning is?
Absolutely. So shark finning is the process of capturing a shark, cutting its fins off, and usually those fins amount to between 5 and 15% of that animal's body weight, depending on species, and tossing the rest of it back into the ocean, most often still alive.
Wow.
And the goal of shark finning is that shark fins are one of the most valuable fisheries products in the world, but shark meat and other parts of sharks generally are not nearly as highly valued. So if you have a small boat, you can carry quite a lot more high value fins if you're not also carrying relatively low value bodies.
And is that a reason why there's such high demand in fishing for it as well? Is that to do with the pricing of the product?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a big difference in terms of how much fishing you have to do, the value of your products. So if you're able to bring in even relatively small amounts of high value product, that may reduce the amount of total fishing that you have to do.
And now we know, because it's quite a straightforward thing knowing what this is. So now we know what it is. We know it's expensive. Why is it so in high demand in regards to price? Why is it so expensive?
So largely because of demand from China and from Hong Kong.
Mm.
There's a traditional dish that dates back to the Song Dynasty in China, made with shark fins, called shark fin soup.
Okay.
And historically, it was eaten only by the imperial court, pretty much.
Okay.
But in more recent years, it's become a special occasion dish for other events, big business meetings, weddings, places where, here in the U.S. at least, you'd serve something like lobster to sort of really make a special occasion of it.
Okay, so it's that real, like you said, celebrated meal or celebration meal, so it's a real special occasion. So, okay, that clears up a lot for me, because this is, I'm already learning a lot about this, because it's kind of, I always knew the, I mean, in my view, a problematic side of fishing in regards to the product and the way it's done. So now I know the reason. But on what level of this method of fishing, shark finning, on what level is that done when we're talking about the quantity of sharks that are, I don't know if you can give a number per year, but a rough estimate of how severe it's done?
Yeah, so it's very difficult to give an absolute number because, as you can imagine, global fisheries, they happen in a lot of different jurisdictions. Reporting can be very variable. Even in a place where reporting is excellent, you're depending on fishermen to be able to correctly identify to the species level species that it can be quite difficult to tell apart.
Yeah.
It's impossible for scientists to tell you an exact number of sharks that are being finned a year and what kind of sharks they are. But for a broad sense of our best guess, in 2000, a paper came out that said that between 26 and 73 million sharks were passing through the fin trade.
Whoa.
Which is not the same thing as being finned necessarily.
Mm.
A more recent report gave the number of between 97 and 267 million sharks total globally killed in the year 2010. Again, not just for their fins, but across all fisheries.
And is that, when we look at those numbers killed, is that looking at for meat and for fish, or is that for everything from accidental catch to kind of tourism, when we look at everything kind of thing?
Yeah, it's an everything number. It tries to incorporate bycatch rates as well as targeted fisheries, which are often for fins, but may also include meat, demand for shark liver oil, demand for cartilage. So there isn't really a perfect number, but the short answer is the scale is very large, and finning is a big problem for sharks. Although I think sometimes in the media it's presented as the only problem in a way that can be problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we're looking at numbers, or let's say estimate numbers of, you know, even if we're looking at like 20 odd million up to, you know, 70 or 100 million, but going up to 200 million as estimates, it doesn't really matter what the number is at that stage. It's kind of, it's got to be problematic.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's such a high number. I didn't realize it was, you know, estimated at that. My next question was going to be, so is shark finning kind of recognized as something that has an impact on shark numbers? But, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing the answer is absolutely yes. How regulated is it as a fishing method? Is it something that kind of some fisheries do? I guess it's hard to look at shark finning because some places will catch the whole shark and use that fin as well. But I guess there's no regulated for just shark finning targeted alone?
So it varies a lot by jurisdiction. I do some work with fisheries in the Southern Caribbean, and there shark fins are not a relevant part of the equation.
Okay.
In some places, sharks are mostly caught as bycatch, but when they're caught, they're eaten. The demand is for the meat, and the fins are sometimes used as lobster bait. They're not being introduced into a global trade.
Okay.
In other places, that global trade is what drives shark fisheries. So it varies a lot from place to place. It's important to make a distinction between shark finning, which is a practice that I think that at minimum you can say is wasteful and inhumane.
Yes.
And the shark fin trade, which is the globalized international sale of those fins. Because shark fins that are in the international trade can come from well-regulated, sustainable, monitored fisheries.
Yeah. Okay, that's a really important point to make. So we've got two kind of... Sorry, I'm just going to try and think about how to word this question. So we've got the industry that sells the fins. We've got kind of two methods that get those fins. Can the industry that sell them sometimes mix up the two? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And so here in the US, we'll see petitions regularly to ban shark finning. But in fact, we passed the Shark Finning Protection Act in the United States in 2000. So it's been prohibited in the United States for years to fin sharks. But people don't necessarily realize that, because it is still legal to sell the fins from sharks that are landed with their fins naturally attached, which is the kind of official terminology for bringing in the entire shark as one biological unit. You can't take the fins off at sea, even if you're bringing the body back.
Okay, cool. So it's a real thing of, you know, bring the whole thing back, and it's kind of, I don't like to talk like this when I'm talking about animals, but kind of sectioned up onshore and then sorted out from there.
Yeah, exactly. And because the fins are the most valuable part of a shark, on some level, a ban on trade in shark fins most penalizes fishermen who are obeying the rules. Because people who are engaged in the illegal trade already probably aren't going to stop. The counter argument, obviously, is that where a legal trade exists, it is much more possible for an illegal trade to thrive in disguise.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about other things that affect sharks. So that's really cleared up what shark finning is for me, and kind of, you know, you can have it from two points of view, or you can, you know, you can sell the product without it being as problematic as it is currently being. What other things affect sharks apart from fishing? I mean, when we look at our side-on-side relationship with sharks from a human level, does that have an impact on shark numbers as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say sharks have a bad reputation.
Yes.
And some of that is down to jaws, and some of it is down to the way that the media talks about sharks, and some of it is natural to human psychology, right?
Yeah.
You know, we find deaths by shark attacks so horrible that it's always front of mind for us. People don't forget reading a news story about that in the way that they kind of don't get stuck on other dangers. Mm. You're much more likely to die in a car accident, but you have a safe interaction with your car or a car almost on a daily basis.
Mm.
And so that conditions you not to be fearful of cars, even though objectively they're much more likely to kill you.
Yes, yeah. And you, like you said, you think, I mean, sorry, I say you think, and that is because of, you know, the media's pressure on that and really hooking on the story rather than looking at the probability of that even happening.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and, you know, people find lots of things scary out of proportion to their likelihood of happening. You know, horror movies are a thing for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
But in terms of statistical risk, the statistical risk associated with sharks is very, very low. Last year, I think there were 5 fatal attacks globally and 64 total. And, you know, we shark scientists don't love the word attack either. You know, we'd rather that people describe them as shark bites.
Yeah.
Because the word attack suggests a motive that often just isn't there.
Yeah, this is something that I've always considered when I've spoken about these, when people say shark attacks and they say shark attacks. And I always say, look, if it was a shark attack, it would be fatal almost every time because the shark would be able to attack and kill. If it's just a bite and nothing more, that was, I mean, obviously it's a very big bite sometimes, but if it's a bite and it goes away, then that obviously shows it wasn't an attack because it leaves, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's quite common here in Florida for folks walking out to wave breaks or waiting around to step on small sharks and get nipped as that shark heads out. And to call that an attack has always struck me as a bit unfair.
I mean, Catherine, I won't lie. My view of if you're in the water, game on. Like, do you know, that's my view.
The way that I feel about it is that obviously it's really tragic. We just had a fatal shark attack here this week in Maine.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that's heartbreaking. And you never want to minimize that when you talk about statistical risk, right? Mm. We shark scientists end up in this awkward trap where, you know, when a fatal attack happens, we want to say, well, you know, this is really very rare.
Yeah.
But that's not actually like a very empathetic response to somebody being killed.
Sorry, I'm not laughing. I agree.
No, but it's tricky because you don't want to fail to point out that this really isn't something that happens very often. But you also don't want to minimize the enormity of the event itself.
Mm.
And here, that issue is really associated, especially in New England, with the what we're starting to see in terms of recovery of great white populations. And so we're thrilled to see these populations growing and doing well. But it also means that people and sharks are going to be more and more likely to come into contact with each other.
And this is where we face this problem, I guess, because as we progress, you know, around the world, but in the Western world, and access to the beach and the ocean is getting, I guess, easier and easier and a higher demand. So as we try and battle to save shark numbers, but then also have an increase of a population that's needed, I say needed, going to the beach and going in the water, like you said, that's where we're crossing paths. And is this something that, as a marine biologist and conservationist, worries you slightly?
Yeah, it does, but it's not even limited to sharks. To a certain extent, I would say that we're in a moment in global history where we have to really think about how we weight our right to be safe anywhere at any time with the kind of healthy, natural world that we want to live in.
Do you think we need to get to the point where we have to accept the ocean is a home to a vast number of predators, and it is an environment we need to look at in the same way we look at the plains of Africa, and somewhere that we should, you know, swim, socialize, be at with caution and respect a bit more so?
I would love to see that. My own experience in talking with surfers who disproportionately bear the greatest risk here, right? They tend to be out further than swimmers. They tend to be out for longer because they're wearing wetsuits.
Yeah.
And they tend to do the best impression of a seal of any human water users. Most of them will say, this is a risk that I accept as part of doing this sport that I love.
Yeah.
So I do think that people have that attitude in at least some cases. But the thing that I would say is, if you don't want to take the risk of encountering wildlife, we have invented pools.
Yeah.
But to hang on to the idea that we're entitled to dominate any landscape that we're in, that we should be able to walk past wildlife in every setting in complete safety, that belief is just not compatible with living in a world that has space for wildness.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the problem I have myself in the way I think of, and I'm sure you share this with me, going, you know, if you're going to enter this, you enter this with respect. And, you know, that can be a walk in your local park, depending on where you live. It's, you know, it can be as dangerous as other environments as in the ocean. You know, depending if you live in the, you know, north of Australia, that can be a risky place to walk. So, but it's the same thing. You go with a bit of respect and caution and know, and a bit of knowledge, really, I guess.
And I think that can be true for terrestrial environments too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that in places where bears live, having bear secure trash cans is one of the best ways to prevent unintended interactions between pets and people and bears. But we are not always willing to invest in that. So we end up having to invest in euthanizing problem bears instead. We know that alerting a bear to your presence is a good way to avoid the risk of unpleasant encounters with a bear. But people walking their dogs near forests aren't necessarily willing to wear a bear bell.
Yes, yeah.
So one of the questions is, like, what are we willing to do to have that healthy natural world? You know, here in New England, we've seen a lot of beach closures associated with white shark sightings, where, okay, everybody out of the water, somebody's seen a white shark. Are we willing to get out of the water? Or is our solution to make sure that there aren't enough white sharks that they really trouble us? The last thing that I would want to say about this is that sharks are everywhere. The fact that you go swimming and you don't see one doesn't mean they aren't present in that environment. You know, when we see drone footage of beaches and there's a shark swimming along, you know, it makes the news here in Miami that people are in the water and here's this little black tip shark going about his business. But he functionally never bothers the people who are swimming. Sharks here in Florida are pretty accustomed to beach-going tourists, and they don't have any interest in them. And secondarily, if sharks were coming for you, they would be much better at it.
Yes. I like that.
so people who are concerned, you know, these incidents are almost always mistakes, and they're associated, you know, especially in terms of serious injury, they're associated with water with poor clarity and with large sharks. And that's not because large sharks are meaner or more aggressive, but because when a large shark makes a mistake, it's more likely to be a catastrophic mistake for the person.
Yeah. And that kind of comes on to my point, what I said earlier with the attacking as well. Like you said, if a shark wants you, mate, it will get you. Like, and that's the same as the attack. If it wanted to attack you, it would. Like, half the time, we're just looking at more inquisitive behavior. And like you said, a lot of sharks, you know, take a test bite before they go in or do a prod. And unfortunately, like you said, the bigger the shark, the more catastrophic that impact has.
But I mean, I do field work with sharks all the time, and I handle sharks all the time.
Mm.
And I can tell you from personal experience, putting my hands on literally thousands of sharks over the course of my career, that the only thing that they want is to get away from me. And in some very limited number of situations, they might be willing to go through a person to achieve that goal.
Yeah.
Although that's not something that's ever happened to me, but they are not aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
When you see them in person, they almost always confound people's expectations of what they'll be like.
And I love that from an animal. I love an animal that will really kind of flip it for you. You expect to go and see it and have this experience, and it completely changes it. And I think that's an amazing thing to happen. If we look at shark species as a whole, and I guess globally as well, are there ones that stick out in regards to numbers and populations that aren't doing so well?
Yeah, well, so first I should say that sharks, and especially if you include all elasmobranchs, which are sharks, skates, and rays, are an incredibly diverse group of animals. We're talking about more than 1,000 total species. So you can't kind of draw broad conclusions about any particular shark because they're a shark. If you ask people to list sharks, they'll almost always say great white, bull shark, tiger shark, mako. But the average shark, statistically, is about 3 feet long, lives on the bottom, you know, doesn't ever trouble anybody.
Yeah.
So some of the big guys that you really see featured on TV are the outliers. But of those shark species, 33%, 345 of them, sharks and rays, are considered threatened with extinction by the IUCN.
Wow.
So as a group, they're not doing well. I think the last time I checked, only amphibians were in worse shape.
Wow, that's a high percentage to be, you know, that threatened.
So the reason for that, broadly speaking, is that sharks are what ecologists call K-selected. And very simply, K-selected means that you mature relatively late in life. You have a prolonged period that you're a juvenile or a subadult. That you invest a lot of resources in each of your individual offspring, so they're each costly to you, and you don't have many of them. So sharks are K-selected. Most bony fish are what's called R-selected, and those are animals that reproduce by strategies like spawning, where you could release millions of eggs in a year for some fish. And the strategy there is every single egg costs very little, but with the amount that you're putting out, you hope that a few survive to maturity.
Yes.
With sharks, you're investing a lot in each individual pup, and the expectation is that a fairly large number of them will survive to mature and reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're giving them such a strong start in life by giving birth to them at these larger sizes and in these lower numbers. That means that if you overfish bony fish that mature fast and produce lots of offspring, you can stop fishing and they can pretty rapidly recover, because the survival rate of those millions of eggs is affected by conditions. So if you've removed a bunch of adults, that survival rate goes up even just a little bit and your population starts to rebuild. And if it only takes a year or 2 years to reach maturity, then you can rebuild that stock.
Yeah.
Fairly rapidly. For some species of shark, you know, it's not that unusual for it to be 10, 15 more years before a juvenile shark matures to the point that it's reproducing.
Whoa.
And for some species, they only have a few pups at a time, and they'll only reproduce every few years. So the more K-selected a species is, the fewer young it has, the more resources it pours into each individual one, the less able it is to ramp up offspring production in response to overfishing.
And is this what, when we talk about sustainable fisheries, is this something that they work very closely along with marine biologists and conservationists with in order to improve populations?
Yes. So one of the things that scientists are responsible for helping to do when we talk about managing fisheries is figuring out the reproductive potential of any species that's being fished.
Mm.
But for a lot of shark species, we don't have that data, or we don't have good quality data. And so if you're even a little bit wrong about its reproductive potential and it turns out to be lower than you expected, it's very easy to have accidentally overfished it. And for some species, you know, you're talking about decades with no fishing pressure before you even have a hope of that population starting to rebound.
Yeah. And that's a long time for an animal as well. That's, I mean, it was a long time for us, but when you said like some animals were taking, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 years to be able to reproduce, and if you do get it wrong, that's a long time to be able to hope that it's all okay for that animal as well.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's even worse for deep sea sharks and for cold water sharks. They think that the Greenland shark may not sexually mature until it's over 150 years old.
Yeah, it's mad.
So, you know, you're not working on a human timescale at that point.
Yeah, and that's the mindset people have to be in, I guess. So when we look at sustainable fisheries working like that, and working to, you know, make sure numbers of fish and shark and different types of sharks and rays and skates and stuff, and hope that the populations increase, is this something, how can people work with that to do their bit to help shark and fish numbers as well? How can they be involved with that?
The best thing that people can do if they're concerned about fisheries is be very demanding about the fish that they eat.
Mm.
I once had someone explain this idea to me as, you know, anything that you buy is a vote for that thing.
Mm.
If you buy it, you're saying, yes, I vote that we make more of this thing.
Yes.
And so if you're very cavalier about the sourcing for your fish, you're a little bit saying, yes, I like the opaqueness of this global supply chain. I will not ask too many questions about where my fish came from or how it was caught. And if anything, you want to be sending the opposite message.
Yes. And a lot of people will say, and I won't put my own view on this, but a lot of people will say, you know, the best way is just to not eat fish, just don't eat fish, and then, you know, all problems solved, the ocean can crack on. I don't know if that is true, but I will ask you, is that true? And if not, why is that not true?
One of the problems with conservation, broadly speaking, is that I haven't found any thread that you can pull to make a change that doesn't make other changes elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you say, well, you know, it would be great to not eat fish. I'm not the biggest fish eater myself, partly because I know too much. We're friends. I don't need to look you in the eye and then eat you the next day.
Yeah.
A lot of fish globally comes from places where people are dependent on it for protein.
Yeah.
Or from places where people are dependent on it for income.
Mm.
And if you eliminate those opportunities, you know, it's not a solution if people are going hungry.
Yeah.
It's not a solution if people who really are dependent on that work are losing work. One of the examples from shark finning is that when the price and the demand for shark declined around 2012 in Hong Kong, a study found that shark fishermen in Indonesia were driven to different environmentally harmful livelihoods, like blast fishing with dynamite.
Oh, God.
Or shifting their fishing effort to other places where it's illegal to target things other than sharks.
Mm.
People aren't aren't going to let their kids starve because you don't buy fish. And I think that that's reasonable.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's one of those obvious things we agree with.
So, you know, you can't just think about it in terms of like this fish is or is not being taken out of the ocean, right? That fish is part of a really complex system in the ocean from an ecosystem perspective. And it's part of a really complex system out of the ocean from a human livelihood perspective. And removing it from that situation has other add-on consequences that you may not like. So I'm not saying anybody has to eat fish if they don't want to. I'm just saying that even if you could enact it, a global ban on eating fish would have a lot of consequences that we wouldn't intend or necessarily like.
And my last question to you, usually what I do at the end of the podcast here is ask people if they could pass on one bit of information to everyone in the world regarding the natural world, what would they say? But for you, I'm going to ask you if you could pass on one bit of information regarding elasmobranch, sharks, skates, rays, just a bit of advice or wisdom about those animals to everyone on the world, what would you pass on?
Can I give two answers?
Absolutely.
So the first would be that in a lot of ways, the story is so much more complicated than anybody expects. And people like simple answers because they're easy. But if you're curious, complicated answers are actually much more exciting.
Yeah.
Right? Sharks, you shouldn't limit yourself to great whites or to, you know, the things that get the most press about sharks, because it's not what's most exciting, at least not to me. Be curious about it and just go looking. There are really incredible resources out there where you can learn a lot more about species that really don't get that kind of attention. And then secondarily, if I were being asked what one thing I would want to say to people about the natural world, it would really be that if you love sharks or dolphins or grizzly bears or any of the amazing wildlife that we share this planet with, nature's not a buffet. You don't get to decide which parts of it you like and value and which parts you don't and you're willing to pass on, right? If you love sharks, then you have to care about how we manage fisheries for fish like mullet that don't get that kind of attention, that don't grab people's interest in the same way, because the sharks that you care about depend on those mullet. You can't write off seagrass as kind of a dirty, gross rack line that washes up on the beach, because that habitat is at the base of the marine food web that allow sharks to thrive.
Yeah.
So if you care about them, the thing that you can do for them is care about the world. They don't need you to sign anti-shark finning petitions. They need you to try to take actions that create a healthier planet for people and for wildlife, that reduce poverty in ways that allow people to pursue livelihoods that don't rely exclusively on extraction. And that will make more of a difference than pointing the finger at fishermen who depend on sharks for their livelihood.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. That was an amazing answer and a lovely chat with you. Thank you so much, and I'll keep in touch and wish you all the best for the rest of the year.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Catherine is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Cat Mac. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod on Twitter and Into the Wild Podcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.